Hello, and welcome to the Brad Pitt Cast, the podcast about Brad Pitt.
My name is Joseph.
I'm Dan.
And we are here to talk about
a film that Brad Pitt appears in.
Although he is billed in opening credits.
He's billed early. It's a film called True Romance. So we just watched this film, as opposed to last episode where we watched the film separately.
Yeah, we watched this together.
We watched this film together, and I'm trying to, in a way that's become symbolic of how we do things on this podcast, poke Dan and try and work out where he sits on this film.
Yeah.
You don't hate it.
No.
You did hate California.
I didn't hate California.
You like this better than California.
This is better than California. I think it's a better film. It's a more purposeful and coherent and intelligent film.
And not as unpleasant. I think doing this podcast has taught me something about you, Dan.
Please, I would hope so.
I think it's taught me
Please tell me, because this is a problem for me, right? Like, I don't always know where to land on things, and it troubles me a little. Like, that I feel like I'm seeking authorities external to myself in order to establish my position on something, or, like, I might have a particular response, but I'm not sure how to interpret it in terms of evaluation.
Yeah.
It's a problem for me.
I think the theme that has emerged for me, which is not surprising, given your academic life, I think you want a film to treat you like a friend treats you.
Mm.
In that I think you want a film to be, and this is going to sound like I'm being rude, but I think that's it's right. True. I think you want a film to be nice, and I think you want it to be polite to you. And I think, weirdly, cinematic politeness is incredibly important to you.
I've got a friend who, yeah, with Lucas, who's come up, who's now a theme on this podcast. Who not only is he a theme, but he wrote the theme of this podcast.
Hey!
And he's a keen listener, so shout out again to Lucas. We've talked about rudeness and politeness in literature as like as a kind of question of academic concern. And I think it is I think you're right to point that out. I think that's a really nice way of putting it. I don't mean that in a, for want of a better word, kind of effete or deferential way.
No. You want a film to be mannered. And yeah. I think that speaks to a conversation that we argue about a lot, is that you want a film to be coherent in the same way that you want a person to, neatly present. It sounds like I'm being rude.
No, I don't think you are. I think there's a few things there. One is, maybe I want a film to be coherent in order to like it. Sure. Or in order to be able to say, I like that. There's things in this film that were perfect and hilarious and extraordinary, and there's a bunch of other stuff that I'm not sure of.
And I think
that's really hard for me to make a sweeping statement about that.
Sure, but that's the politeness thing.
There's just something about, I mean, maybe we'll talk about this for now via True Romance and see if we can get to the bottom of it. Because I don't think you've done extremely well, but I don't think we're quite there, right? No. Maybe in talking about the film.
In talking about True Romance. Let's do a brief bit of context, is that right?
Yeah, yeah, please.
So this film was written by an under-discussed, under-referenced artist. Dan's not laughing.
That's good.
His name is Quentin Tarantino. Nobody talks about him. He doesn't inspire insufferable online discourse.
Quentin who?
He's a little bit he makes me think actually a little bit about Martin Scorsese.
Sure.
Who's someone else who, when I read discourse, doesn't make me want to fucking die. Yeah. Right? Like, I'm totally, give me that discourse.
We need more conversations about these guys.
Please do.
There's not
Please
enough
do.
Talk about them that is unmoored entirely from the art that they made.
Yep, and ungenerous and bad faith.
Yeah.
And related to political discussions that people
have
spend their
to
lives
do with
having.
These.
Yeah, yeah.
Artists.
Yeah, more of that.
Something. Mm.
So Quentin Tarantino, that guy, also very humble. I'll stop now. Yeah. What else could I say about Tarantino?
He made a film with Brad Pitt in it recently.
Yeah, he
did. We'll get
to
it eventually.
We sure will. Tarantino makes a film called Reservoir Dogs, which I don't like. Do you like Reservoir
I've
Dogs?
I've seen it once. I don't. It didn't make that much of an impact on me either way.
Sure. And in making Reservoir Dogs,
I'm skeptical of Tarantino in general.
So maybe this is the time to have this conversation, right? Mm. When I am a young film snob, I was extremely snobby when I was a teenager, in general, about all things. I thought that the values in life came from, forcing yourself to read War and Peace.
Sure.
Which I read when I was, 17. And it's, my supervillain origin story. Because I hated doing that stuff so much that now I hate the idea that you have to process those kind of big, awful works of art that suck.
War and Peace doesn't suck.
War and Peace is so bad.
We don't need to talk about that
now. It's bad. I don't hate all Russian literature. I love Anna Karenina.
What about Dostoevsky?
I love Dostoevsky.
Okay, of course you love Dostoevsky.
I love Brothers Karamazov. Yeah, he's talking about things that I care about. Yeah. And Tolstoy is not. I don't give a shit about any of that shit.
You should read... Have you read Tolstoy's essay about what art is? You'd hate it.
Yeah, I can fucking imagine. Yeah. I can fucking imagine. Yeah, fucking... Anyway, fuck you, Tolstoy. So I'm a snob. As a 16-year-old, I'm forcing myself to read these things. I watch Reservoir Dogs, and I'm like, I don't like this.
Yeah.
A couple of years later, I make myself watch Pulp Fiction, because it's on all these lists. Sure. I'm like, I like this even less.
Yeah.
And I thoroughly check out from Tarantino.
Which is, I should say, to your credit, as a late teen film snob, that's pretty self-directed, to not like not to check out entirely, but just to resist appreciating Pulp Fiction, resist liking Pulp Fiction. I think that's... That shows you have a real strong internal compass.
I think how loud I was about not liking Tarantino undercuts what you're saying.
Sorry.
I still don't like Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
I don't, you know.
I think it's fine. It's kind of funny. A good performance by Tim Roth.
I just find it masturbatory.
Definitely. See, that's the thing for me. All Tarantino is.
But that's, okay. So this is the thing, right? I think... those early films with Tarantino feel to me masturbatory and empty, because I'm like, what's the project here? What are you trying to do? I don't understand. This guy just likes the sound of his own voice. And so because I'm so resisting...
He never really gives that up, right?
I don't think that's true, though. Because... So I don't watch Death Proof. I've completely checked out. I don't see Inglourious Basterds at the cinema.
Oh, wow. That's... Okay.
And then I'm having a mental breakdown in living in Coventry in England, having an extremely bad time. And my local library, Coventry Library, has copies of Alan Moore's Swamp Thing and Inglourious Basterds on DVD. And I check these things out and I watch them and read them again and again and again and again and again for weeks. And I become convinced that Inglourious Basterds is one of the, like, ultimate pinnacles of American art. Okay. I'm not so hot on it anymore.
Sure.
I still find it, like, insufferable. A little bit, sometimes. But how I feel about Tarantino now is he perfected the art of... Like, Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction are obviously propulsive.
Mm.
They're just kind of undeniable.
They're watchable.
If they're on and you're in the room, you watch them.
Yeah, and you want to watch, you know, John Travolta speaking slowly to Uma Thurman or whatever. Like, that's interesting.
Yeah,
like, that scene, like, they're dancing. Yeah, that's he knows how to make something look good.
Yeah.
And absolutely.
Yeah.
And look cool. He's really good at cool.
Yeah.
Except when you can tell how cool he thinks he is. And then it all falls apart.
Sure.
Which I think is the case with every Tarantino film I've seen. For me.
My big thing is I feel like with Inglourious Basterds, with Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, he learns... how to A, say something, and B, how to care about human beings. I think Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is a masterpiece. I think Inglourious Basterds is a masterpiece too, because there are real resonant emotional through lines in those movies that he eventually realizes, like, oh yeah, movies should be about people. I think
I don't know if Inglourious Basterds is about
Shoshana,
people.
Shoshana, the Jewish cinema owner.
It's fine. It's still kind of cliche. I saw it once at the cinema whenever it was out at the cinema.
Well, what's your Tarantino story? You hate him from the...
It's actually... it's kind of important because I am not too... this may shock you all. I'm not too exposed to violent films as a teenager, as a young man.
Extremely then, not exposed, right? To the extent that you don't really watch
violent I basically haven't
stuff.
Watched anything MA until I'm like 16, 17.
Yeah.
Because I'm kind of scared of it, right? Like, I just don't enjoy having horror, like... And I don't mean horror in the... genre sense, but horrifying things inflicted on me, it's not something I enjoy. It's something I'm probably a bit too scared of it. And then I, in my late teens and early 20s, there is a Blockbuster near where I live, and I walk down to it and regularly start, like, just renting what's on the art house shelf. So I have this weird mix of films. I see, like, what I see, Dogville, 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days, Blue Velvet,
do you like
Mulholland
Dogville?
Drive. Yeah. I mean, again, I saw it a long time ago. I liked it at the time.
Yeah.
I just hired a bunch of films, but all sorts of things. Like, not just good cinema, terrible cinema as well. But Pulp Fiction is my friend Andrew, dear friend from childhood, sees it and loves it. It's the first R-rated film that I see. I go to his house. I also first saw The Matrix with Andrew, which was also a film I was a little bit scared of at the time, but enjoyed enough, although I think I threw up after watching it. I don't know why. But I remember this kind of sickly feeling around The Matrix, seeing The Matrix. One of the first, like, action films I saw. But I see Pulp Fiction, and I think I'm relieved that it's not as kind of viscerally upsetting as I thought it might be. Like, you hear about this film, you hear about the scene with, you know, the gimp suit and whatever, and you imagine this, like, for me, at least, someone who hasn't seen it yet, like, this total visceral, disgusting nightmare, which it isn't. It's quite funny, it's quite lighthearted, and so I kind of enjoyed it. But then I think Tarantino is also important, so I see... What else do I see? I see Django at the cinema, I see Inglourious, but I see Inglourious Basterds at the cinema. I get Reservoir Dogs from... I agree, I don't think that's a good film. I see Reservoir Dogs... I get Reservoir Dogs from the blockbuster. I see it in order to become, like, roughly film-educated, and I see Inglourious Basterds, Django, because, like, friends of mine are seeing it at the cinema. I see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with my friend Joseph. We suggest that we start a podcast. It ends up being a podcast about Brad Pitt, which I don't think we knew at the time.
No.
I think we just suggested the idea of a podcast while we were waiting for that film to start. Anyway, Tarantino is important because he becomes kind of the archetype for me in terms of what violent cinema is, which is something that I have been scared of and then kind of tried to create a moral argument against, maybe. But I think what tends to happen is if someone is saying there's too much violence in cinema, I will argue against them. And if someone is saying violence in cinema is totally fine, I will argue against them as well. So Tarantino is this kind of figure through which I use to locate myself in terms of how I feel about this. And I think I quite like Pulp Fiction. So I think this is at least a clever film, but I always remain, but he's too violent, but he's gratuitous, but it's kind of dumb. I think there's always, like, it's not as smart as he thinks he is. So I don't know how articulate any of this is. Sure, but there's like wavering
back and forth
around him.
Sure.
I quite enjoyed Inglourious Basterds. I think, like, that's the thing. His films are propulsive and watchable. They're always good. Like, I quite enjoy Death Proof.
Yeah, I like Death Proof.
That's another one I got from Blockbuster. I think because that's also, like, such a genre flick. He's really investing within a very strong vision.
Yeah.
And also his kind of out-of-this-world dialogue works so well in that universe.
Yeah.
He's not trying to do anything real. Yeah.
I think, and this is going to sound like an insane thing to say, but it dovetails nicely into True Romance.
Sure.
I think Tarantino, despite it being one of the things for which he is well known, I don't think he's very good at violence. I think he thinks that he's being very cool with the violence. And I watch a lot of films where, like, I watch a lot of violent films. Most of what I watch is extremely violent. So I know that you can make violence quite cool and that maybe there are moral problems associated with that, but you can genuinely do it. I don't think Tarantino almost ever does it, with the exception of
Kill Bill.
Kill Bill is great.
I mean, Kill Bill, it's about... Like, again, I've only seen parts of Kill Bill. I've seen the first half of Kill Bill Volume 1. For whatever reason, didn't finish it. But it's... Like, that film so entails its violence. Like, it's clearly about that. Yeah.
There's a thing...
You can't imagine that film without the violence.
Yeah,
at
exactly.
All.
There's a thing that a philosophy lecturer I had once said, which I always think about because it just feels such a beautiful way of saying it. He said, the nature of pain is exhausted entirely by how it feels. So what is pain? It's experiential.
Mm.
That's what pain is. Sometimes I think the nature of Kill Bill is exhausted entirely by the violence and the experiential nature of that violence. It kind of is like, well, what the fuck are we talking about if this film's not violent?
Exactly. I think you could actually imagine Inglourious Basterds without the violence. Sure. I think it would look something like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Sure. Which is why, when I say this insane thing of, like, Tarantino's not good at violence, as someone who broadly actually is on board with Tarantino now in a pretty serious way, I think he's pretty great. When I think about what are the best moments in Tarantino films, almost none of them are violent. Or they're in the shadow of violence, but they're not themselves violent. There's neon lighting up in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. There's this exchange in Inglourious Basterds where Shoshana is talking to her friend and she's standing on the stairs and they've just agreed that the Nazis are going to do it at the cinema, and you see her like, I'm going to kill these fucking Nazis.
Mm.
They're beautiful, real human moments that are not entailed with violence. And my final thing about why I think what proves or helps this argument that Tarantino sucks at violence, I think the violence in True Romance is very well handled. And it's well handled because it's by Tony Scott, who is, like, I think one of the premium cinematic artists of, like, the last 100 years. I think Scott is much better at violence than Tarantino.
That seems fair to me.
Can I briefly do the story of Tony Scott?
Go for it.
Tony Scott has an amazing origin story. So Tony Scott is the younger brother of Ridley Scott. He's 16 years younger than Ridley. So
is that right?
That's sure sounded like some bullshit when I said it. It's either 16 or 6.
Okay.
There's an age gap. It's not 60, but it's 16 good. Or 6. It's
got a 6 in there.
So Tony wants to be a painter. And he's like, I'm going to be a painter. But he loves fast cars. And his brother Ridley is making a lot of money working in advertisements, working in commercials. And Ridley says, hey, Tony, you love cars. If you come and work with me and shoot commercials, in a year's time, you'll have a Lamborghini. And Tony's like, I like cars. I'll do that. He signs up a year later, he has a Lamborghini.
Great.
So greed is the origin of Tony Scott. Tony Scott then makes a series of not very well-liked films. He makes a film called The Hunger with David Bowie and Catherine Deneuve, which is a vampire film, which is capital E excellent. I'm making the capital E thing my trademark.
It's fine. It works.
You would like The Hunger.
Okay.
Then Scott is kind of like bumming around. Like, that film didn't work for him. You can see if The Hunger works, maybe he wants to be like a serious auteur.
Mm.
Instead, he just goes to Hollywood. He's bumming around. For years, he tries to make Interview with a Vampire, which will later be made by Irish filmmaker Neil Jordan and will star Bradley J. Pitt.
Mm.
So Scott just bums around, and then he's like, oh, there's this script. It's about planes. It's about dudes flying planes. Maybe I'll make it. He makes the Serkian homoerotic masterpiece.
Top Gun.
Cinches his career. But the story of Tony Scott in terms of his... He is hated by critics. At the time, critics hate him. Ebert, who I think is an idiot and is wrong about most things, liked True Romance.
I've never liked Roger Ebert's
He's a fool.
Criticism.
He's a fool.
I'm going to make a knot at home on him.
He's a... You don't want to say he's a fool?
No.
He is wrong about everything.
I basically agree with that.
Have you seen him talk about fucking Blue Velvet?
Yeah.
Wrong.
He's wrong about Blue Velvet. I think he's more than... I've always been baffled at the... If you have an argument for Roger Ebert, email us at thebradpittcast@gmail.com. But I've always found him just to be... he describes films.
Yeah.
Literally, his reviews are just describing the plot. I've always been baffled by his deification.
And you know that quote that people adore that he says that Ebert is like, films are empathy machines?
Yeah.
No, they're not.
No.
I don't watch movies for that reason. I watch movies to see fucked up shit.
That's you.
I'm different to you.
You're different to Ebert.
Yeah, I'm definitely different
to Ebert. I get the film's empathy machines line and why it resonates with people, but I worry about that kind of talk.
It's bullshit.
It's not entirely bullshit.
It's pretty bullshit.
You feel for people when you watch movies. That's important. Sure. Like, that's an important part. Like, I think reducing them to that is insane.
Yeah. You don't... No one sets out to be... And, in fact, we've had this discussion, but the filmmakers I hate the most are the filmmakers who are like, I'm going to do a social good by making people think about
that's,
other people.
No, that's the worst.
That's
definitely
fucking
the
YouTube
we can agree
and Bono
on that. Yeah.
Bullshit. I don't want that. Get that away from my
that's
art.
like The Blind Side or something like that.
Yeah. Claire Denis, director of High Life, when people were saying to her, oh, you should make your films more morally instructional, she's like...
I hate that, yeah.
She's like, I'm not a social worker. That's her quote.
Perfect.
It's true.
Yeah.
Fuck off. The best art is morally reprehensible.
That's not true.
Just poking you, Dan. Poking you right to that.
Good art can be morally reprehensible.
Sure.
But the two have nothing to do with
it. It doesn't have to be morally reprehensible. It's just
the
most fun when it is.
Okay.
Tony Scott makes a series of films at the time. If you read a review of a Tony Scott film from the time, of which I've read many because I like reading about Tony Scott, nobody talks about Scott. He is at the time regarded as like a journeyman. He's like, I don't know who you'd...
Mercenary.
Yeah, he's like a gun for hire. He's going to come, he'll like service your lead. One of his most long-standing creative partnerships is with Denzel Washington. And so he's just seen as the guy that like Denzel calls up when he wants to make a movie.
Sure.
Scott commits suicide in 2012, dies tragically, real sad. The Counselor is dedicated to him, which I told you and you were
It's a hell of a movie to have dedicated to you.
You know the worst thing? Scott dedicates The Counselor to Tony. He also dedicates Exodus, Gods and Kings to Tony.
No.
Yeah. His like biblical epic that sucks.
This could be incorrect. It doesn't matter.
No,
I feel like the guy who wrote The Irishman wrote Exodus, Gods and Kings.
Steve Zaillian is the guy who wrote it. I mean,
he wrote a movie like Exodus: Gods and Kings.
Let's just say that's the case.
It could be. Like, yeah, it. It's a weird. There's some weird. So I was looking at his filmography.
Yeah, it's a more pleasant world that we live in if we think that Steve Zaillian wrote Exodus: Gods and Kings.
Yeah, let's not look it up.
No, let's imagine that we are firmly in that world. And then what happens is there's this wave of critics, including a critic called Ignaty Vishniev, who writes for the AV Club, who is the spearhead of this movement of critics who are what are called vulgar auteurists. And they look at these people who are supposedly handymen who do nothing. The men in that is like, I mean, makes a pointed thing because obviously we're talking about Hollywood cinema in the late 90s and early 2000s. These are unfortunately male-dominated circles. Mm. So there's this idea that, these are just regular guys. And Vishniev and lots of critics like him are like, actually, these films say more about the societies in which they were made than films by much lauded, more established directors.
Oh, they have social messages?
They preserve social messages that they don't endorse.
Okay.
True Romance certainly contains.
Yeah, no, sorry, I just couldn't resist. Just
trying to poke me, yeah, Daniel Dixon. And Scott, you know, when Tony Scott died, all of these critics who had ignored him tried to do this fucking, like, because obviously he died under extremely tragic circumstances as well. So all these critics tried to do this fucking cartwheel of being like, oh, well, some of his films are good, and you have to admit it. The thing about Scott, which will be, I guess, the last thing I want to say about him, is like, yes, you can watch a Tony Scott film. He made Enemy of the State, starring Will Smith.
Hmm.
Bad film.
Sure.
But not a bad film.
Okay.
Because I spend time in the company of my friend Tony.
Yeah.
Who sees the world very differently from me, and who is very good at expressing how he sees it differently.
That's interesting. And you think True Romance is a successful expression of that difference?
I think so.
Can you tell me what's different about the way he sees the world?
Than what I see?
Yeah, like, what is the distinction?
So,
This is a genuine question. I'm not saying this in terms of, I just want it articulated.
Tony Scott, and this sounds like I'm being a dickhead.
That's okay.
Tony Scott really, 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 really thinks that people are good.
Yeah.
In an extremely basic way.
Which is funny because I do too.
Yeah.
And I think those moments are what I like about, I mean, True Romance is a pretty cynical film. I'm thinking not about the, yeah, sorry, you continue.
No, I mean, that. I think that's genuinely the biggest difference.
Okay, well, let's do that then. I mean, so should we talk about the plot?
It's a hard plot to talk about.
It actually weirdly is, and I think it's not a coincidence that we've taken this long.
We'll do vague, but if you
had a point, go on. I was going to say, my point was just that the central couple in the film, he seems to think they're good, but the forces arrayed against them...
Yeah. But they win.
Aren't.
They win.
Yeah.
They very simply and uncomplicatedly win.
Which... You could also then, there's ways of thinking about the inherent goodness of everyone in the film in that they all have personalities, right? They're not archetypes. These are people who have moments of connection and moments, like, there are quite a few of those. The cops near the end when one gets shot, the mob boss who's genuinely played by Christopher Walken, who gets genuinely offended.
He always slows down.
It's funny. As I cast my mind back over this movie to try and recall specific examples from it, it felt like I watched 5 movies.
Yes.
And it's almost, I wonder how much, I would be really interested to look at a, like, you know how with Netflix you can, like, scan along the bottom of a, scan along the specific word for the...
Scrub.
Scrub, thank you. And just see the different scenes, like, roll by. I would be fascinated to see the color shifts in this film, because the first half is in Detroit, the second half is in California. But I reckon that each act has a different palette.
Sure. And each act is insane. So I think in doing the plot, what?
Well, let's talk about the premise of each act and roughly what happens. I think we actually need to go into a bit more detail on this than we do usually because it's such a mess.
Sure.
Broadly up front, and then we can just talk about it.
Unless my thought was maybe we do plot like as an overview and then just do characters.
I agree. Also, I agree because apparently the original Tarantino script, which is changed by Scott, was out of order, chronological order.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah.
This film is not fun to watch if it's out of order.
That's probably true. Although, like, Tarantino isn't just shifting the order around. He's doing a whole lot of other things as well.
Sure.
Right?
But this
film, it would be a different film. It would be a totally different film in order to be fun. This film, as it is, would not be fun out of order. It would be distressing.
You just never know what the fuck is going on.
I mean, it's unpredictable enough as it is.
Yeah. As you say, it's a couple of movies shoved together.
And it's only 2 hours. It doesn't drag, but it feels much longer. It doesn't feel like, oh my God, I'm still watching this movie, but just so much happens.
Yeah, a huge amount happens. So what does it start off? It starts off with Christian Slater and Patricia Arquette. Slater is obviously a Tarantino analog.
Yes.
He's a nerd. He loves Sonny Chiba movies.
It does say on the Wikipedia page that Tarantino said this was his most autobiographical script. Yes,
of course. 100%. Yeah. He loves movies. He works at a comic book store. He loves music. He's very aggressively knowledgeable about fairly niche things like Elvis Presley, although not niche, obviously, but like you don't expect specific a young taste. Person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very specific taste that the character is very proud of.
Yeah. Eccentric, right?
Yeah. Meets Arquette. And so, I mean, how much do you want to get into the fact that there's some problematic shit in this film?
I mean, there's been problematic shit in so much that we've done so far. Yeah. I don't actually think it matters that much.
No, because my argument...
Sorry, not that... whatever.
No, but what I think you mean more is...
Please.
I'll dig you out, Dan. Here's a spade. Let's go. So, the Patricia Arquette character, who's called Alabama, is something of the manic pixie dream girl stereotype. She's like... What do we know about her? We know that she's kooky, and we know that she loves Christian Slater.
Yes.
She is defined by her love for that character.
True. Does this film pass the Bechdel test? I don't think it does.
No.
Absolutely not. Is there even a second female character in the film?
Do you know something about the Bechdel test? The look at Dan's face. Most feminist films don't pass the Bechdel test. Beau Travail, the Claire Denis film, written and directed by a woman, very much about toxic masculinity. Of course it doesn't pass the Bechdel test, because it's filled with men. There's no women in that
film. I'm going to push back on the most feminist films thing, but it's fine.
I think, obviously, we need more female representation and more... And this is a film that is, like, quite, like, stomach-churningly male at some points, in a way that, like, feeds into the worst of, like, toxic male
That's true, but most of that doesn't really bother me because this film is not endorsing that, really.
No, so this is... So the important thing about the meet-cute is Arquette is, like, a crazy, wild, manic pixie dream girl, and she meets this guy, drops popcorn on him, and then you learn that's artificial.
Yeah.
In a way
sort of. Yeah.
Yeah. Slater's boss at the comic book store has hired her. So she's a call girl. Yeah. Which leads to a back and forth, which is full of, you know.
Not great stuff.
Not great stuff. But...
So she reveals to Christian Slater that she is, in fact, a call girl. He says, I don't care, I had a great time. Yeah. And then they're in love, and that's, like, 10 minutes into the film.
Yeah.
It's relationship, they meet each other in a cinema, they have sex, they have the conversation, it's dispensed with, they get married, and then next thing, they're walking down the courthouse steps.
And while,
which I really like, right? Like, it's like, we need these two to be in a relationship, we're not going to have them in a relationship at the beginning of the film, they'll never have met. We need a relationship early. Let's handle it. It's handled rather deftly.
Yeah, I think so.
Like, narratively deftly.
And this is the thing, right, which I was talking about. My feeling about this film is that this is a wrestling between two very distinct auteurist voices. Quentin Tarantino, who is glib and mean and dispenses of people. And actually, I think Tarantino's overriding feeling is that people are bad. Like, they're bad, they do mean things. It's not so surprising that his films are about Nazis, the slave trade. I'm not saying he's endorsing those things.
No.
But he's looking for the biggest possible backdrop to prop up with what he already thinks, which is that people are shit and do shitty things.
Do his films even reference the real world in that way? Or are they just about movies?
I think Inglourious Basterds is genuinely about Nazis. It's about a love for cinema.
Yeah.
But it's about what does it mean to love like movies Hugo. in an Inglourious Basterds and Hugo. Yeah. That's a double bill.
Were they actually in the Oscars in the same year? They might have been.
Oof.
It Hugo, doesn't matter.
Hugo sucks.
Okay.
Hugo's a bad film.
Sure.
More killings it's in fine. It, please, Martin Scorsese. Just have
more werewolves.
Yeah. Have George Méliès just like fucking straight up kick that kid in the face. Let's do it. Yeah. You know, you have to sometimes play into the worst aspects of your character, Dan.
Most distinct, not worst.
So True Romance is a film written by someone who takes great pleasure in evil people, filmed by an auteur who really loves people.
Yeah, and wants to find the good in everyone, pretty much, and finds it, I think.
Yeah, so you have this insane tonal wrestling match in the film. Like, you have Hopper. Dennis Hopper gets introduced around this. Oh, no, we have to do the Gary Oldman thing.
Yeah, which so is crazy. I think I can go through this plot quite quickly.
Go on, do it.
Christian Slater gets mad. He's talked to by an imaginary Elvis in the bathroom. The bathroom tells him that he should... The Elvis tells him that he should kill Patricia Arquette's...
Pimp,
who is played by a dreadlocked Gary Oldman, who speaks in what can only be described as a vocal blackface, although that is referenced in the film that he thinks he's black.
Yeah. He has lines like, you must have thought it was a good day for white boys.
Yes, exactly.
When it's he is white.
In insane virtuosic performance.
It's by an Gary incredible Oldman. Performance.
It's a really good... He inhabits that character, and it is very convincing and very moving, yeah. I think. But... He's God, first introduced
moving
in
is
the
interesting.
Scene.
How moving?
Well, he's just such an intense... He's a character who lives so intensely in his world and has such a clear vision of what his world is that I think it's just like the sheer... And I think that's the Scott thing. I think the sheer totality of his personhood makes you not feel for him. He's a terrible human being, but like be moved by his intensity.
Go on.
I just want to quickly say he's introduced in a scene where... He's shit-talking with a bunch of guys, one of whom is Samuel L. Jackson, who within like 30 seconds he kills with a shotgun. Just kills a bunch of guys, and that's not really necessary for the plot at all. You just see him.
He's a baddie.
Yeah, although we could find that anyway, right? Yeah. Like, that's sure, he's evil, but Samuel L. Jackson has like 30 seconds of screen time, and he's done.
All I was going to say is when Slater goes to confront Oldman...
Yeah, which is the thing that happens next. That's the next scene with Oldman. Slater is like, I'm going to kill this guy because Elvis told me to.
Yeah. The Slater character comes in and says to Oldman, and is like, this is the other argument against the film's problematic politics, right? That actually Slater is under the thrall of toxic masculinity. He watches all these Sonny Chiba kung fu movies, and he thinks he's like them. Although you could argue that the film ultimately ends up saying he is like them. He discovers that he is a bit like them.
Yeah, sort of, but it doesn't really work out for him, right? No. Like, the actual getting involved, he gets away in the end, but nothing came of that. Nothing good comes of that. So I actually think, there's this dude living in a comic book world, this Tarantino surrogate.
Yeah.
And when he's actually... You could actually compare it to David Duchovny's character in...
California. Sure.
As someone who has these fantasies that are kind of literary and removed from real life, and then he is confronted with this world in real life, and it ruins his life.
Sure. But Duchovny in California is punished for having those fantasies. That whole film is... I think you described it on the California's episode as someone having their nose rubbed in the ugliness of the world. Whereas... Because Tony Scott is a sentimentalist, he doesn't hate Christian Slater for having these delusions. No. Scott kind of weirdly doesn't really hate anybody, which is insane with a film filled
with... Yeah, and I
want
to talk about that in a reference to a few specific characters who are, like, awful, but he still shows love for them.
Sure. So they have this back and forth, Slater and Oldman, and Oldman, I think, has... One of the standout moments in the film for me is Oldman goes, like... You've given yourself away, he says to Slater. He's like, you're coming in here being all weird to me. And if you'd sat down and you'd eaten the food that I'm offering you, I'd be like, oh, this is just a guy. And in fact, what he says is like, I think you wouldn't have a care in the world, and maybe you don't. And it's just this like, it's I think what you say about Scott and the totality of, you just learn that this is a guy, Oldman tells you, I'm always thinking. And like, that's weirdly involving to learn... Like, Oldman is despicable.
This is a guy who's strategizing.
Yeah. He's been sitting there. You think he's just been staring at Slater. And then he says, I haven't just been staring at you. I've noted this, this, and this.
Which Tarantino, if Tarantino were to film this, which is something we would discuss quite a bit during the watching of this film, like, how would Tarantino do this differently? He would have mostly been interested in Oldman's coolness.
Yeah.
And his superficial, like, signifiers.
Yeah.
Not the contrast between this guy's internal and external world.
Yeah. Scott is someone who was called kind of like cutting edge and flashing MTV generation, lots of fast cuts, but actually I think he's a classicist. And I think what Scott thinks most as a filmmaker is you get two very good actors. You don't need to do anything. You just need to go from mid-shot to reverse, a couple of wides. Like that back and forth with Oldman and Slater is just...
Yeah.
There's no crazy angles. There's no quick cutting. It's just a very simple coverage of two people talking. He does the same thing in a later scene, which we'll definitely talk about with Pitt and Gandolfini.
Yes.
Which is like... It speaks for itself.
That's the scene of the film, I think, for me.
Sure. Keep going. You said you were going to do the plot quickly.
No, that's okay. So... Oldman and Slater get into such a confrontation that Oldman launches himself at Slater in like a totally out of this world shot, which is very funny. You discover Oldman's wearing shorts
Tidy whities.
Yeah. And Slater wrestles a gun from him, shoots his bodyguard, threatens a woman where in the like house that they're in, the building that they're in, and takes a bunch of stuff.
He says to the woman, put all of Alabama's stuff in a suitcase.
That's right.
And then he takes the suitcase and discovers that it's filled with cocaine. So now he's in trouble.
In a kind of No Country for Old Men twist.
Yeah.
yes.
Or have you ever seen the Louis Malle film Elevator to the Gallows?
I've not.
That's an excellent film about two petty criminals who steal a car to like do a getaway, and then they discover there's a dead body related to a different shooting in the boot of their car. So they can't go to the police about this dead body because they themselves are criminals.
Great trope.
Good film. Elevator to the Gallows. Such a good title.
It's a good title. And so he rushes home, eats a hamburger, takes Patricia Arquette.
To meet his dad.
To meet his dad.
Played by Dennis Hopper.
A wonderfully sentimental and felt performance from Hopper.
Yeah. Weird to see Hopper be a good guy.
Yeah. Although Hopper, you see him, the kind of tension of Hopper. Hopper is like, clearly a little unsettled that his son has just married this woman. And then Slater asks his dad for help because his dad's the next cop. He says, can you find out whether these guys we killed, whether the cops know about it? Hopper discovers that they don't know anything about it. But in that, Hopper does kind of emerge into himself and yell at Slater a bit, yell at his son, which is like vintage Hopper.
Yeah.
But he's a complex character that does... This film is really full of virtuosic performances in three or four scenes.
Yeah. People who don't... I mean, you're someone who likes your characters to have history.
Yeah.
There is no history in the script. There is an overwhelming amount of history in the performances and the direction.
Yeah, it's true. One of the biggest problems I have with this film is I just don't get what Slater's doing. Like, he's just not... I don't understand. He's surely, like, why is he not more scared? Why is he not more thoughtful? Why does he love Patricia Arquette so much? Why is he so willing to immediately fall for her? Why he never self-reflects. There's just zero self-reflection.
But I guess this is a difference between you and me as watchers. It's like, if the film ticked off those things and told me those things, I would be bored.
But they just have to be gestured towards. You need the slightest thing.
I don't even know. I just feel like I don't need it. Because I can get that from a film about those things.
But that's what's interesting to me. Like, I'm interested in what someone does based on the conditions under which they're placed. But I only understand their responses to conditions if I understand something about them. And if I don't, I can just see the person typing, and then this happens because it's interesting, and then this happens because it's interesting.
But Scott...
I don't care about that.
Scott tells you he's kind, he loves his wife, and...
But he's not kind. This is the thing, there's so many contradictions.
Slater is kind.
No, he's not. Like, he's extremely selfish, he doesn't really think about other people. He loves his wife nominally, but only shows that in, like, lust... And kind of like there's no scene in which he,
I love them. I genuinely
really care about them.
Okay.
I just didn't really care about them. They could have died at the end and it wouldn't have bothered me enormously.
What?
Only because it would have bothered me a little because I've been like, oh, what was the point of that film? I'm not happy at the end when they're like on a beach together.
That is
it doesn't.
The craziest shit I've ever heard.
Because I don't feel things. I've not given reasons to care about them.
But
it's a film that does a lot of wonderful things in scenes, but Brad Pitt plays a vastly more fleshed out character than Slater.
I don't think that's true. I think...
Because he's coherent. He's like one or two things and he's responding to a bunch of situations in consistent ways. And you get really clear... I mean, sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. They go on their honeymoon. They leave Slater's dad behind.
Chris Walken shows up.
Christopher Walken shows up.
And says to Slater's dad, I'm going to kill you, basically.
Yeah, your son left his driver's license at the scene of the crime.
Which is funny.
It is very funny. Where did he go?
Because that's the gap between who Slater thinks he is and he actually is, right? Which is where the character lives for me, and why I have sentimentality towards him.
But I don't know why he's reaching to be that other person.
Because he's grown up with it. It's all he knows. It's the performance of masculinity, which weirdly we've talked about so much in this podcast.
Yeah, I guess. It just didn't quite hit for me.
But you learn enough that Slater's parents have got divorced, and he says he hasn't seen his dad for 3 years. He's looking for father figures.
Okay.
And he populates it with, like, these weird... violent, strange fantasies.
That's true. Okay, I buy that enough, but it's still...
And the key in that is that Scott doesn't think he's a bad person for doing that.
I agree.
Scott loves him.
I definitely think Scott loves him.
Yeah.
Whether that's deserved...
But see, and this maybe is also something just about cinema, right? When I see that Tony Scott loves this guy...
Yeah.
That's where the film lives. It doesn't even matter. I love him because Tony Scott loves him.
I don't care about that in art. Like, that's like a thing. There's one thing amongst a million different things that art can give me.
But this
is just such a specific thing.
But this relates to... No, you see it crop up everywhere.
No, I know, but it's such a specific... I know it crops up everywhere, but it's such a specific thing about art.
Yeah.
Like, it's a thing that can happen, and it's kind of interesting, but it's not at all overwhelming to me.
But a thing that... Jumping ahead, not in plot, but it's just like a flourish later on. There's a drug deal that goes down on a roller coaster.
I love that.
And that's... You love that because you're like, Tony Scott fucking loves roller coasters. That's what you're seeing. But he loves also, them so much, he puts the film on hold.
But it all, no, but that's the thing, is the film's not on hold. Suddenly we have a real thing that is not just about plot,
sure,
that is detached from the character. Suddenly we have characters who want to go on a roller coaster. It's like, oh, they want something.
Sure.
And they want something that is... Like, the reason in, like, when you're an actor... Like, the reason Brad Pitt's good is because when he's acting, he's doing something with his hands. And that tells me more about Brad Pitt. And the roller coaster is the film doing something with its hands.
Sure. But it does something with its hands in regards to Slater, too, I think. You can see the loving wide shots of his face, watching micro expressions.
Why does he love him?
Why does Scott love him?
Yeah.
Because he's a good guy. And
that's not enough.
But Tony Scott thinks everyone's a good person.
Yeah, great. So what's distinct about... Why am I watching him as the protagonist? There's like eight people in this film who I'd prefer to see as the protagonist.
But the film kind of agrees with you
about
that. Because Tony Scott loves them all. But he doesn't love Slater any less because he loves Brad Pitt and he loves James Gandolfini.
I agree, he does love James Gandolfini.
Go on.
Walken kills... There's a wonderful conversation. Walken kills...
Extremely famous monologue by Dennis Hopper about Sicilians, full of expletives.
Yeah, classic Tarantino classic expletives.
Yeah, it's the thing we talked about on this podcast about how Kant's most famous section, the philosopher Immanuel Kant, also has like horrendous racism in it.
Yeah.
A little bit true of Tarantino too. Like, here's the thing that people talk about with him, and it's full of like extremely regressive stereotypes of about three different ethnic groups all at once.
Yeah, although you might be able to argue that in Tarantino's case, the slurring entails the quality of the narrative rhythm is entailed in the slurs,
sure,
right?
Which and also,
like, I don't...
The electricity of the scene...
Depends on that.
Yeah. Hopper is slurring the ancestry of Christopher Walken, who we already know is definitely dangerous.
Yeah.
And Christopher Walken responds with laughter.
And,
there's your tension immediately.
It's wonderful. It's a wonderful scene. Yeah. And Hopper is also resigned to the fact that he's going to get killed at that point.
Yeah. Yeah, Hopper has this, like...
Oh, his face.
Wet-eyed Americanism.
Yeah, which is why he's so good in Blue Velvet.
Yeah.
Because you can still see that even in his total villainy.
It's such a sad performance in Blue Velvet. Like, It's one of the best performances, I think, because he's sad. He's fucking Frank is so sad.
Yeah.
He's playing out like the most basic Freudian fantasies because he has no interior life.
Yeah, that's a what a tragedy.
What a tragedy! What a fucking perfect film.
Blue Velvet is. Yeah, thinking about Blue Velvet.
But Blue Velvet and True Romance share a lot in common. Blue Velvet is about young lovers who also maybe, if you could say, you don't super care about. You don't super care about Carl McLaughlin and Laura Dern
the
in that
Chicken
film.
Walk.
Oh, I love that, though.
There's nothing like the Chicken Walk in True Romance. No, there absolutely isn't. There's no moment where you go, oh.
I go when Patricia Arquette is looking at Christian Slater at the end on the beach and he's got...
But that's too late. This is when Laura Dern and Carl McLaughlin are suddenly... They're suddenly electricity.
I feel the real electricity between Laura Dern and Carl McLaughlin when she gives the deranged speech about the birds. And that's pretty late. When she's like, the robins are here. Fucking bonkers.
Yeah, that's...
What a...
Magic. Pure cinematic magic.
So what happens next?
Oh, what a better film.
No, it's not.
Blue Velvet is much better than True Romance.
Yeah, sure, but that's like saying fucking... That's like saying that what that Letterboxd review guy said last time.
But this is why I have problems rating films, is because Blue Velvet is five times better than True Romance, and True Romance isn't a one-star film, right? Like, it's just fucking stupid.
Damn.
Five-star...
The way you do it is you say five-star is like a category in itself, and Blue Velvet is a five-star film, and True Romance is definitely not a five-star film.
Yeah.
So five-star films live... Because your five-star films are your favourite films.
Sure.
And of course, you might not love True Romance, but you didn't have a bad time.
No.
I'm just trying to... This whole podcast is a secret way to get you to update your fucking Letterboxd, Dan Dixon.
I think I'm getting further and further from it. I think I'm getting more confused.
God damn it.
So
then it becomes this... Then this bizarre... Suddenly a gangster film starts.
Yes. So there's this... Like, we keep referencing these... This... So Christopher Walken was associated with...
Mafia.
But also the... Him, what's his Gary Oldman's character?
Yeah, Drexel.
And yeah, Drexel. So he's like, hey, you killed Drexel, I gotta come after the guy who did it.
Yeah. And then this machinery of evil
kind
of
which starts. Is actually kind of Lynchian.
Yes, very Lynchian.
And
it's seen in Mulholland Drive where everyone's like calling each other, more and more evil people talking
exactly
on the phone.
And all with just these kind of like unassociated to anything, but you know they're evil.
Yeah.
I think I'm okay with unexplained evil anyway. No, we don't need to get into that now. And Christian Slater calls his friend in California, another film in LA, heading to
played
LA.
By Michael Rapaport.
The film starts in Detroit, right? And he's on the way to California. Played by Michael Rapaport in a really enjoyable performance, very funny. To say, I want to sell. Do you know someone I can sell this coke to?
Yeah.
I've got $500,000 worth of cocaine.
Yeah.
Where can I unload it?
Yeah.
Rapaport is in a class with a guy who he thinks will buy the coke, has a connection who will buy the coke.
Yeah. Now, the reason why Dan has wanted to speed through this plot very quickly, because he now wants to talk for 4 hours about, what the fuck is his name? Bronson Pinchot. Let me look up to make sure.
Bronson
that's
Pinchot,
right,
also in After Hours and a film with five. What was the tagline of that film?
Oh, amazing. So
we looked up Bronson Pinchot's filmography because he looked so familiar. I love After Hours, the Scorsese picture. He's in that. And he's also in...
So Bronson Pinchot, I'm finding it on Letterboxd because it's incredible. We discovered that he's in a very popular sitcom that none of us have seen called Perfect Strangers.
Perfect Strangers.
So Bronson Pinchot, I'll run you down because it starts pretty solid. True Romance, After Hours, Beverly Hills Cop. Fantastic film, Beverly Hills Cop. Risky Business. I love Tom Cruise. I'm a big Tom Cruise fan. The First Wives Club. You know, we're still like respectable films even if they're not quote unquote good. Beverly Hills Cop 3. The worst. The best one is Beverly Hills Cop 2 because it was directed by
Tony Scott.
Antonio Scott. His first name is not Antonio. Lady and the Tramp. Anthony? Courage Under Fire. Quest for Camelot. Okay, now we're gasping for breath a little bit. It's My Party. Sinking. I don't know what the fuck that is. Blame It on the Bellboy. And here we go. Slappy and the Stinkers.
Slappy and the Stinkers.
Do you want to know this tagline for Slappy and the Stinkers? 5 kids, 1 sea lion. No rules.
No rules.
No. Zero rules.
You thought there were rules.
If it was flipped, it would be crazy.
Five
if
rules.
Was, if it was one kid, 5 seasons. Yeah, or...
Well, 5 rules.
Or no kids, 5 seasons.
And one rule. What's the rule?
Don't talk about Fight Club.
Don't talk about the sea lions.
Don't talk about sea lions. Oh, that's incredible.
Maybe we should write that film based only on that.
Maybe we could write like 20 films based on like
different iterations of the number of sea lions, kids, and rules.
Do you want to know how many people have logged that they've seen?
Can I guess?
Slappy and the Stinkers.
108.
406.
Whoa.
It's 78 minutes long. It's a lean...
If we were to do the Bronson Pinchot cast, we'd have to watch it.
Do you want to know the reviews? Oh my God.
Is it around 2 stars?
Ooh, I've just kind of freaked myself out a little bit.
Uh-huh.
One of the top reviews is by a guy called CJ Probst. His profile picture is a sperm, and this is his review of Slapping the Stinkers.
Do I want to hear it?
The air has been sucked from the room a little bit for me.
We don't have to do this.
When I return, you will be the first to know. I know your name.
What have we uncovered? Is this going to be a The Ring scenario? Have we accidentally The Ringed ourselves? Or I Know What You Did Last Summer?
Yeah, we're all dead now. Because of fucking Slappy and the Stinkers and Bronson Pinchot.
Okay. Bronson Pinchot's performance is the best thing about this film.
Dan is in love with Bronson Pinchot.
He just has...
He's definitely not the best. That's a bizarre thing to say. There's so many incredible performances. Including one by fucking Brad Pitt.
And James Gandolfini. Yeah. It goes... Brad Pitt and James Gandolfini tied for first, and then Bronson Pinchot second.
Sure. Bronson Pinchot is a wannabe actor with a floppy fringe and a cardigan around his shoulders.
And a face made of rubber, right? Yeah. He looks like a Calvin Klein catalog model in 1992.
Sure. Or he looks like a very off-brand Jim Carrey rubber mask.
Yeah,
from definitely. Like Aldi or something, like a shitty quality version.
And so they hook up. So the other important thing is Michael Rapaport's roommate, who we might even meet before we meet Bronson Pinchot.
We do.
Is Brad Pitt.
His name's Bradley J. Pitt. And he's playing Floyd.
He's playing Floyd, which is the perfect name. He is. We see him. We're brought back to Rappaport's house. Brad Pitt's on the couch smoking pot.
He never moves. He's basically on the couch.
Right at the end, he's standing up drinking a beer.
Yeah.
But almost exclusively on the couch. He's always consuming something.
Yeah.
He's so good.
He's incredible.
You know what? This is probably his best performance so far. In terms of an entire character that is flawlessly inhabited. Only because there's so little
screen time. Sure, it sounds like you're being flippant about his other performances. No, not because the others have been terrible.
No.
It's because this is extremely good.
Yeah.
He's wearing a wig, which is insane. He's got a little goatee.
Is it like a Prince... It's not quite a Prince Valiant, but it's...
No, it's quite Kurt Cobain.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
You said Soundgarden, too.
Well, Soundgarden was playing, and I thought... I saw him, and I thought, oh, he could play Chris Cornell. So there's, grunge icons.
Oh, sure. He's smoking bong made out of a honey dispenser at one point. Would you like to know what I promised you was a thing about Brad Pitt's character in this film? Many years after True Romance is released onto an unsuspecting audience, a young comedian named Seth Rogen watches this film and is so inspired by Brad Pitt's Floyd that he writes a film called Pineapple Express.
No way!
The James Franco in Pineapple Express is modeled after Brad Pitt on this film. And the whole point of that film is Rogen thinking it's really funny to think about this guy who is a minor character in the play. It's like a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern
dead
kind of scenario where he's like, what is that guy doing?
Yeah.
Who's unaware of the film that's happening around
Which
him.
Is a great... And also, what a great way to write a story, right? Yeah. Like, you don't have to come up with it all yourself. You just ask one question of another work of art.
Yeah, and you've made something extraordinary.
Yeah. Oh, actually, is Pineapple Express good? I have seen it.
I really like
Pineapple Express. I remember thinking it was... I honestly don't remember what I thought of it.
Sure. It's directed by a guy called David Gordon Green, who starts out making, extremely emotional... indie projects about living in a broken America called George Washington, and then he makes Your Highness and Pineapple Express.
Oh, yeah.
There's a great making of documentary on the Pineapple Express DVD where David Gordon Green's parents are interviewed, and they're very stern people, wearing button-up shirts, and they go quite genuinely with quite genuine hurt in their voice, they go, yeah, he moved from the art house to the outhouse.
Oh.
The disappointment of
that's ruinous.
Does David Gordon Green discover that when he watches the making of DVD? So Floyd is this side character. He's not aware of the fact that there's cocaine changing hands. He doesn't seem aware of anything at all. Just these mafia men keep coming to the door,
yeah,
and talking to him through a fly screen.
And he just gives them the information they want. It's like where did these people go? And he's like, oh, they went to this hotel.
The truly transcendent moment in the film is this scene, which you're saying is the best scene, where Gandolfini comes to the door.
So James Gandolfini was in the background of the scene.
He cuts Hopper's hand.
Yeah, when you first see Walken.
Yeah, he's a bad guy.
Yeah. And so he comes to the door, and there's this wide shot where Gandolfini's at the door. He doesn't come in. He's just standing. You see him through the screen door. Brad Pitt is lying on the couch. And Gandolfini just asks him for details about where these people went. And Brad Pitt just gives up the information, then asks him if he wants to join him for a joint.
And the funniest bit is Gandolfini walks away. And Pitt to himself is like, don't condescend me.
He's really angry.
Yeah, I'll fucking kill you. Which is funny because he's unaware of... Gandolfini would actually kill him. Like, he's quite unaware of how close he came to true danger.
Yeah.
You were worried that Pitt was going to die.
Yeah. Yeah, I was.
That it's directed by Tony Scott, and maybe if it was directed by Quentin Tarantino...
Pitt would go.
Yeah, but Scott really, I think, genuinely, has sympathy for Pitt.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I think he loves Pitt. He also loves Gandolfini.
He definitely loves Gandolfini.
And Gandolfini is... A brutal heavy, not just standing in the background, but actively hurting people.
There is a scene which you can imagine Tarantino wanking himself off when he's writing, when Gandolfini is talking to Patricia Arquette and talking about how it was initially hard to kill people and now it gets easier and easier every time. And there's this scene which you can imagine Tarantino being like, look how rock and roll and cool I am.
And how scared Patricia Arquette is.
Yeah. And Scott films it Gandolfini is really, really sad.
Yeah, which is also the genius of The Sopranos, right? Is the way in which it makes gangsterdom trivial and tragic.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what this scene is preview reel of Tony Soprano.
Yeah. Gandolfini is sitting and he says something to Arquette like, he's like, now I just kill him to watch their expressions change.
Yeah.
That is terrible. And that's not, if you, yeah.
And he's not doing it threateningly.
No,
he's just like, this is all I have left.
Yeah, he's just sitting on the couch staring at the floor. And then he's quite brutally killed with like a series of increasingly unpleasant means of dying.
Yeah, I mean, he's sent there by Brad Pitt chasing down Slater and Arquette, and he gets to Arquette first. She's in the hotel room and he brutalizes her in a number of ways that I found very difficult to watch, more difficult than anything we've watched so far.
Really?
Yes, this was the most difficult film of the podcast for me. Absolutely. 100%. What else is there?
I don't know. California.
No, it doesn't have as much violence.
And the
violence
isn't. Yes, it does.
No, this has more on-screen violence. I think absolutely more prolonged on-screen violence. There's even the violence in that scene. There's not that much in California.
The urinal.
But that goes for like 20 seconds. It's not extended.
So much blood.
I didn't look at that. I also shied away from that. But that didn't seem as long. And also, you don't know the guy. And it shoots it from, like, above. It's not, like, right in there for a lot of it. Sometimes it is, but it's careful about what it does. The most upsetting scene in California for me was when Brad Pitt takes the glass out of his stomach.
Oh, sure.
Because it's shot from below, and it's, like, really close in.
Yeah, sure.
But no, this was very hard to watch. I'm just astonished. Because it's a woman being totally brutalized and, like, being... there's nothing I hate more than wounds that are aggravated. Like, when someone's already cut somewhere, we saw the film Ready or Not, horror film at the cinema a while back, and there's this scene where the protagonist, she already has, her hand is fucked up.
She got a hole in her hand.
And it gets
fucked up. She sticks a nail through it.
She sticks a nail through it. She's climbing up in a nail. And even thinking about that causes me agony. And that's kind of what happens in the scene between Gandolfini and Arquette.
You make me feel like such a sociopath when I'm sitting across from you recalling the scene and like... not flinching. Is that bad? Am I a bad person?
No, it's got nothing to do with how you interact with the real world.
Exactly. If Dan, if I saw you put a hole in your hand through a nail and be like, Dan, you were right. I would like want to make
you
sure you're okay.
You do the requisite things that resolved it.
Yeah.
You wouldn't stare uncaringly.
No.
Yeah, and that's all that matters really, right? So. I mean, empathy machines.
Shut up, empathy machines. There's a critic who I actually don't like always called Nick Pinkerton because he likes Terrence Malick, and as we know, it's their problem. Pinkerton said, cinema is not empathy machines. It is hideous images scraped off the surface of the id. And sometimes I agree with that.
It can be all sorts of things, though, right? True. I think that's important.
You can't be totalizing
about cinema at its most glorious might be that.
Yeah, scraped off the... is Lynch. Lynch is just scraping off his id. And
You could probably say the same about Wes Anderson.
Sure.
100%. Those are hideous images scraped off the surface of the id.
You know that something insane about Wes Anderson? Do you know a film that's extremely important to Wes Anderson?
What? Tell me.
Heat.
Oh.
What do you do with that information?
I did nothing.
How do you live the rest of your life? I don't know. He watches Heat all the time.
Okay.
Can you imagine him?
Like sitting in his down cord in his pants perfect, with on his perfect couch.
Yeah, his wife's like a French fashion designer.
Yeah, on his wooden television.
Yeah. Watching Heat. And what does he say about it afterwards?
I don't know. What is he? I guess he's interested in the sense of loss, maybe. Like, he loves loss.
I guess so.
And, like, but that...
what is Wes Anderson going to, like, Hoyt's George Street
look like? Yeah, that's a good question.
To see Ready or Not with, like, a popcorn.
Yeah,
because he loves movies and he watches them.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you and I create things sometimes. And we consume a lot of things that aren't like the things we make. But it's still crazy.
Yeah.
That...
yeah. I just can't imagine Wes Anderson doing anything.
No, I can't either. I would want him escorted. Like, he needs to be taken from cinema to cinema.
I just imagine Wes Anderson...
I mean, I can't imagine he lives in LA, right?
But he does, doesn't he?
I think he does.
Do you know a thing about Wes Anderson that I don't know what to do with this information either? So I was a young teenager... very into IMDb message boards, very across things like the thing I'm about to tell you.
Can't believe it.
When I knew Wes Anderson first, when I was first introduced to him, he had spiky hair, spiky, very short hair, big teeth, and just wore parkas and glasses. And he always looked like a nerd. And then, when he makes The Life Aquatic, he ditches the glasses.
Oh, is that contacts. Even during Rushmore?
Yeah, he looks like that.
Oh, that's interesting.
He grows his hair extremely long, and he starts dressing very dapper. And Angelica Houston said about him on The Life Aquatic, she said it, maybe a problematic quote, she was like, he became beautiful. So what happens to a person when they do that? It's a genuine question.
Well, it's an interesting question as well, because a lot of directors are generally dressed quite shabbily, right? And are not thinking about themselves, they're thinking about the image. And Wes Anderson incorporates himself into the very mannered and curated image of his films.
Yeah.
Like, that's obviously the guy who makes the Darjeeling Limited, right?
Absolutely. And I love that. I mean, we talked about Gaspar Noé looking like the films that he made.
Yeah.
We talked about liking James Ellroy because he resembles the work that he makes. I kind of love... like
I appreciate that.
Tony Scott...
it suggests an authenticity.
Yeah. Tony Scott on the sets of his films is always wearing long khaki shorts, a cap. He looks quite a lot like Ridley, but he wears a cap. And he wears this vest with hundreds of pockets. So he's like stuffing notes into his pockets. He smokes cigars. And that's the guy who makes True Romance.
Yeah, for sure. Bit. Definitely.
Why do I love that?
I don't know if... just quickly, I don't know if this is being picked up, but there's some like incomprehensible machine operating outside the window that might have been picked up by the mic.
Last time we had a bird going...
yeah.
We've got the whole time
sound beds,
and this time we've got a... we're also up in my room again, so we're hot.
If you want to send us some cash, we don't have a Patreon, but if you want to send us some cash, you can buy a studio. But until then, you're gonna have
an entire studio.
We
need one benefactor, Wes Anderson.
Yeah, if there's one very rich person.
Yeah,
if every listener to this podcast gave us $1 million, we'd be able to buy a studio.
While we're up here, I just want to quickly, briefly sidebar, because I mentioned being up here. I have an item sitting next to me.
Yeah.
And I want to tell a story about it. So I'm sober.
Mm.
I don't drink. I haven't drunk. I've been sober for like 376 days. today, I came...
I'm only laughing because I'm looking at the item, not sure. He knows. Confessing a sobriety.
I came to my house, and on the steps of my house... was this object.
Oh.
It is a comically oversized hip flask.
It's when maybe the size of my head. It's bigger than your head.
It's bigger than my head. And on it, it says... I'm going to open it. So it's like real ASMR.
Was this wrapped up on the steps of your...
no, sitting like this. There you go. It's coming out of the...
It's been unopened and now you're getting the...
So it says, I don't have a drinking problem. I'm just really thirsty. So, joke. Funny. What the fuck?
Really?
Is someone... am I in a Saw film? Like, is someone...
Is this the dude who reviewed Slappy and the Stinkers?
Yeah. Yes! It's the fucking I know who you are guy. Dan's opening the hip flask. I mean, you could never...
when do you use this?
Yeah.
Only it's a hip flask a giant would wear.
Yes.
Or if you wore this...
does it... the
lid it's like, it's like open? A bachelor. I can't... well, no, it's got a... oh, fuck.
the curse, Dan.
it's pinched my finger. It's not really opening.
Dan can't open it.
Oh, wait. Got it.
So, what do you put
nothing
in
there? It's probably inside it.
It's probably more than an entire bottle of vodka.
Definitely. This would be like a... this might be a litre.
It might be
a litre. It might be a litre hip flask.
So, is someone...
and also, it's got three fonts. I don't have a drinking problem. What's a drinking problem is in quotes. I'm just really thirsty.
Is someone going to kill me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably. There's no other logical outcome to this situation.
So. I did think so.
Stainless steel. It says that on the bottom. It's from Giftworks. For the fun of it.
Do you want to know something true?
Do you really not know where this came from?
I have no idea. It was propped up on my steps. I messaged the house and I said... So I messaged the house. I was like, is this anyone's comically oversized hip flask?
Yeah.
And they said no. And then I said to Brianna, listen, maybe someone's trying to murder me.
Yeah.
And Brianna said, you do have a lot of enemies.
Yeah, the Timothy Chalamet person who... Chalamet stand that you... after you reviewed Beautiful Boy poorly.
I badly reviewed Beautiful Boy. I'm serious.
This is insane.
Yeah. It might just be a coincidence, right?
I would say... well, so what are the options? It's coincidence, it's someone
Christmas
fucking with
party,
you.
Walking by, and someone got that in their secret Santa, and they're drunk, and they throw it. It's felt very arranged. Or, like, we're being funny, let's arrange it on the steps. It freaks me out.
Yeah, it I'm sorry. Well, no, look, I'm sure it's all fine.
When it happened, this happened today, earlier today. When it happened, I was like, well, I have to talk about this on the podcast now.
Yeah, you got to manifest it somehow.
So, and what the fuck am I going to do with that thing? Do you want it?
I mean, I'm not going to say no immediately. You know, it's like the Babadook. You put it in the bin, it'll turn up on your fucking step again.
Don't say that.
Drag Me to Hell, right?
It's the button. It's the cursed button. I'm not a fan. Anyway, let's just like put it so it's watching us. There it is. Dan's propped it up.
It's behind me.
Staring.
Sorry, do you want to see it? Should I turn it around?
Yeah. No, turn it back. Maybe I'll take a photograph. We'll put it on the Brad Pitt Twitter page. Dan looking very serious.
Incredible.
I don't know how to go on with it there. It's like a memento mori. Yeah,
it is. Well, I mean, it wasn't me, obviously.
I'd be pretty amazing if you revealed incredible? It was you.
That would be...
You would have had to come to my house.
And it would be so... I mean, it's...
It'd be cruel.
It would be cruel, wouldn't it?
That's the thing. Yeah. Brianna was like, maybe it's a joke. And I'm like, that is a weird joke. Like some kind of cruel... Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, if you want to help us solve the mystery, maybe this could become like a... Finding Richard Simmons or whatever, where we switch to a true crime podcast about who put the...
Through.
I don't have a drinking problem, I'm just really, really thirsty. On my hip flask on. Joe's doorstep.
Where were we? I got a pop on my lantern. This has made me so stressed I'm having acid reflux.
True romance. We haven't really talked about Bronson Pinchot. Bronson Pinchot is unbelievable in this.
He's a wannabe actor.
So they meet him at a theme park. In order to, like...
Offset the cocaine.
Unsuspiciously make a deal about how they will get rid of the cocaine. And this wannabe actor, he's just very... I can't even describe why he's so funny. I mean, just his... He expresses himself as such a loser who thinks he's pretty handsome, but in kind of a slightly creepy way.
Wall Street, Silicon Valley.
Exactly,
Bill Gates.
But a little bit hedge fund investor dude.
Yeah.
Thinks he's pretty cool. But is worried about the deal, is kind of an anxious guy, clearly very self-interested entirely. Entirely concerned with his own interests.
Well, in the film's climactic shootout, all of this is leading up to a shootout between...
I think we can speed through everything basically of the shootout, right?
Because it's Slater and Arquette are trying to offload the coke to a movie producer
who's a friend of Pinchot.
Knows. The cops have picked up Pinchot and have a wire on him, so Pinchot is like... double-crossing his friend, and then the Sicilians turn up.
Yeah.
So it becomes this comical, like, we referenced...
Yeah.
It's a mad world.
It resembles that in its heightened absurdity.
Yeah, that just...
Everyone arriving at the hotel room, people are, like, pushed by various forces of fate that are specific to them, but they end up driving them all together because of this bag of cocaine, which... Yeah. This is actually... It's a road trip. There's... cocaine instead of money. There's a lot of, that's quite mad worldy about this.
Yeah.
A lot of characters, a lot of bit part actors who do extraordinary memorable performances by just turning up.
Yeah.
Living in their own world, often seeming like they're acting in different movies.
Yeah.
Like these characters that kind of very American in its breadth of variety.
Yeah.
And often only with access to their part of the movie.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Not aware of the cog that they resemble in a much bigger machine. Which I think if you want to do a read, which I feel in my heart you'll probably say is overly generous.
I'd say.
This film is about people who are unwitting players in a bigger machine that maybe is being mobilized for evil that they don't know about.
It's a cross between No Country for Old Men and It's a Mad, 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 Mad World.
Sure. I think that perfectly describes it, actually. Yeah. I really do. And I think we keep coming back to it, but I don't think Tarantino is thinking about... the tragedy of being a cog in a wheel. He just thinks it's kind of... He just wants to write characters.
Yeah, he is... The cogs in the wheel are in service of the degree of shock and surprise and cruelty you can exercise on these people because of their unknowingness.
Yeah.
Whereas with Scott, the unknowingness turns into a sweet naivety.
And that's sometimes the key, a tragedy, a sadness.
Yeah.
Yeah, because...
What you see in Gandolfini, you kind of see in Pitt.
And you definitely see... There's this big shootout... Coke explodes, the pillows are being shot.
Yeah.
And then there's just this scene where...
He should say, the reason they're at the shootout is because Bronson Pinchot flips, because he's caught with cocaine in his car.
Yeah.
In a very funny scene in which a bag explodes all over his face as the cops approaching and he's trying to hide it. And so he flips and wears a wire.
Yeah.
And so the cops are able to, like, burst in as the Sicilians do.
Yeah. And then there's this big shootout, coke and feathers and down. And then Scott does something Tarantino definitely wouldn't. And he has this moment where there's a cop who's like, oh, I've been shot.
They shot me.
Yeah.
Like, surprised.
Yeah, like, surprised that he's going to die. And the down and the feathers are kind of settling on everybody.
Like snow.
It's this very surreal, but... And this is a filmmaker who Scott resembles in terms of his career. But I think in terms of emotion and sentimentality, the filmmaker that Scott most resembles is Douglas Sirk.
Hmm.
He has a lot of Sirk's sentimentality, melodrama, and real depth of feeling. I think this film, in Scott's direction, resembles All That Heaven Allows a little bit. It's kitsch. It's about two people who want to be together, but the world is evil and it's drawing them apart.
Sure.
And Doug Sirk was like a German who came to America and is not recognized by Scott critics.
Scott is obviously British.
Yeah, exactly, coming to America. I think there's
kind of Europe. There's also the, yeah, I think absolutely in the cartoonishness of its Americanness.
Yeah.
And the relish with which he uses these big American figures instead of Rock Hudson, you have James Gandolfini, right? Yeah, like,
absolutely.
These kinds of.
These granite.
Startlingly
American.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The diner scenes. It's a viscerally American film.
Yeah. And All That Heaven Allows ends with, in the winter, with the snow. And I genuinely wonder. You know, the problem is, and this is, I've often talked to Dan about, like, one thing I really want to do is to write a book about these vulgar auteurs where you just, I mean, you obviously can't sit down with Scott anymore, but you sit down with someone like Michael Bay, because it keeps me up at night being like, has Tony Scott seen Douglas Sirk? Because the problem is, nobody interviews Tony Scott when they interview him. Yeah. They're like, what's it like to work with Denzel Washington? So there's this, like, gap of information about these, like, deeply creative people who you just don't know what they were thinking. And, of course, I get joy out of that.
Sure.
But I don't want to know fucking Tarantino's origin story. I want to know Scott, the guy who thinks he's no one and is actually everyone.
Yeah. It's the like, place in the geography of things, right?
Yeah.
So, well, where do you fit in relation to these people? And are you just emerging from some very specific personal series of quirks? Yeah. Or are you placing yourself within a tradition of cinema?
Yes.
What are you in conversation with?
Yes. The person I want to do it most with is Paul W.S. Anderson. Have you seen any Anderson films?
I don't
films?
Think so.
You haven't seen Mortal Kombat or any of the Resident Evils?
No.
They're all great. Okay. I mean, Anderson makes, his first film is called Shopping, and it's really beautiful and very adored by critics. And then he goes to America and he makes films that critics call the worst films of all time. And I just want to sit down with that guy. And I just want to be like, what do you think? What are the... Because he writes all of his films. Like, I just want to know what that world is like. I tried messaging him, direct messaging him on Instagram. I tried messaging his wife. He's married to Mila Djokovic. I want
to... It seems like a bigger leap, to be honest.
What? That Mila
messaging, Djokovic... It seems more less likely that Djokovic will reply than...
They've both then ignored me.
Okay,
I'm sorry. I can't do
sure
it
you can
Tom.
Find the email address of like the production company or.
I've tried with Paul.
When's his next film coming out?
He's made a video game adaptation of what's it called, Monster Hunter or something. There's a beloved Japanese series.
Oh, yeah,
of
Monster
games.
Hunter. Yeah. Is a very weird game. So they're making a movie out of that.
He is. It's made.
That's
coming
strange.
Out next year. I think
it doesn't
it
have much
bomb.
Narrative apart from the fact that you hunt monsters.
I'm really worried.
And like spend a lot of time with various. You cook things, I think, to
really?
Like make it easier to hunt the monster.
I hope it goes okay. Paul's last couple of films have bombed, and I worry they'll make him do a Marvel movie, which he won't want to do. And then, what do you do if you can't make a Marvel movie?
I don't think they're making him make. They're not. They want respectable people.
They also want people without a distinctive voice.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Who were we talking about
Michael
recently?
Michael Bay, we were saying would never be able to make a Marvel movie.
We saw Six Underground, which is one of the films of the year, and... we were talking about how, yeah, because that film is absurd. The characters are constantly talking about comic books
and movies and how they're not in a comic book movie.
Yeah.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah. There's also a scene. Do you want to quickly do the Six
Underground
scene that is transcendent?
The Inception one?
The Inception one is extraordinary. I was talking the Bad Taste one.
Oh, yeah, of course. I'm so sorry. There's a bodyguard in this elaborately beautiful penthouse guarding a key player in the film, and he's huge. He's like the Incredible Hulk. And it's kind of great. Like, you see him, but then there's suddenly a shot where in the background of the scene you notice, or like it's kind of foregrounded a little
You're
bit.
You're aware that he's in the room.
You're aware that he's in the room, and then all of a sudden you see that he's wearing a shirt that has arrows pointing up and down with labeled the man and the legend.
Yeah. So a bad dick joke.
And then, yeah, like a bad dick joke. And then one of the characters in the scene, his boss, is like, what are you doing? You're embarrassing me. And he says, I'm sorry, I have bad taste. And
see,
it's really funny. Very funny.
When you've subscribed to vulgar auteurism for years and you see something like that,
It's good. It's really well. The rhythm is elegant. I don't like the film as much as Joseph likes that film.
It was unsurprising.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
But I had a good time, and some moments in it are really sharp. It's just too messy for me. Ultimately, It's again, and there are parts where it's not as clever as it thinks it is. It's not quite as smart as it wants to be. It has where it like. Has moments where, these people are intelligent. They're not actually that intelligent. I just can't quite forgive that.
Out of that movie uplifted.
I had a good time. I had a good time.
You had more than a good time.
I enjoyed it.
Damn. I've seen different shades of Happy Dan. That was, you were uplifted. I know it. You can say whatever you like on this podcast.
I like the film.
The image lives in my mind.
I had a good time. I'm not denying that.
Great film.
I promise.
One of the films of the year.
I'm not going that far yet. I need to wait till December 31st.
What are the other films you've enjoyed this year?
Marriage
Story. You haven't liked anything.
No, I'm joking.
You can like Marriage Story if you want.
I fucking love The Irishman.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So what else? The Irishman, Midsommar.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is pretty good.
Dragged Across Concrete, would you put it up there?
I'd have to do some serious reworking of my brand.
You could indulge
it's,
it.
That film's too cruel for me. I respect it, but it's too cruel.
Okay.
It's very, like, it's just, it's not, I just want to, like, I'm watching that in a very specific context with you. I want to know what it's like if I'm sitting at home alone watching that. There's moments of pure joy. Like, with the guy who plays Cy Abelman in The Bank. Like, what a goddamn scene. But I don't want to watch Mel Gibson and Vince Vaughn be sad for 2.5 hours. Like, that's not my idea of a good time.
We come to cinema for different things,
it just,
you and
it
I.
Feels,
and
it feels like, you know, it feels like a metal scraper across the top of my mouth or something. Like, there's something deeply uncomfortable about it.
You're an interesting person, Daniel Dixon. You know, the funny thing, the great
so are you.
The great thing about being friends is,
tell me,
the more I learn about people, the more I'm like, I don't understand that at all. It doesn't, it's not clarified, it's obscured.
I'm sorry.
I love it.
It's great. I try to be clear. All my life, I'm just trying to get clear on things.
It's great. We could do,
struggle.
We could do 4 hours of this podcast every day for 10
years.
Yeah,
that's definitely, it would be unceasing, absolutely.
And we would never find out anything.
What Patreon level are we doing 4 hours of this podcast?
Not much, man. I need some money.
Yeah.
What happens at the end of True Romance?
It's a job, sure.
Yeah.
I would do this as a job.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah.
I'll do it on whoever you want. It doesn't have to
No, we just keep working through them.
Yeah. That's the end, really. They make it
away. They survive in the original script.
In the original script, Tarantino wanted them to die, which is crazy. You can't kill these people.
You can't kill them because we've seen the Scott version, right? That seems important.
I don't like this film if they're that expendable that they can be killed.
I agree. I think
I don't know what the film is about.
I mean, I think this film is a really excellent demonstration of what's wrong with Tarantino because it makes it right, right in a lot of ways.
It's also an excellent demonstration of everything right with Tony Scott.
Exactly. No, that's what I mean. Is because because you can see how Tarantino would have done it, and you can see what's wrong with that.
Sure,
that's what I mean.
Sure. That's true.
Are
you interested to see another Tony Scott film?
Sure.
Are you a little bit suspicious of my love for him? Do you think that you would probably have a bad time in these films?
No.
You're very polite and you're very kind to me. So sometimes I'm like, if I said, right now we're going to watch the Denzel Washington runaway Trey film Unstoppable, which was Tony Scott's last film, would you be a little bit like, I'd prefer if we didn't watch that film?
I'm very open to things.
Sure, that's very true.
And I'm very open to things recommended by people I respect, among which I count you, obviously.
Sure.
And I respect your taste.
Sure. Is that true?
Yeah, it is.
How?
Because I think it's because I think it's considered.
Okay.
No, I don't. I won't agree with it.
Yeah.
A lot of the time, perhaps, but I think I never ever think you are constructing a viewpoint for anything other than articulating your own responses.
Sure.
And that is something I respect enormously. It's so rare. And I don't think I can get there. And part of, I think, the struggle with this ongoing conversation that the Brad Pitt cast constitutes is that I am much weaker at that than you. I can think about things and I can talk through them, but I'm so confused about my responses to the world. It's not that I'll, like, it's not that I just defer to what you say about a thing. I'm certainly willing to consider it. But it's that I'm willing to consider it, right? So, no, of course, like, if you say something's really good, I'll spend time with it.
Sure.
And think about, like, the limits would be around what I can tolerate emotionally.
Sure, sure,
so
sure.
It wouldn't, and, like, maybe, but it would be hard for me to imagine getting bored by bored with a film that you loved, because I would be like, well, what's Joseph C in this? And that's enough to keep me going.
That's the joy of cinema watching, and it's the joy of having taste.
Well, I think for you, to some extent, part of that is like, what does the director say in this?
Yeah.
And in some ways, that's your in, right? Yeah. It's like, well, someone did all this and took it from idea to completion, and maybe it was kind of beaten about by various variables and interests along the way. But like, what's that vision?
Yeah. Which is why the worst films are the films that gesture towards other people's vision. Or, like, I don't, you know.
Yeah, like, I mean, for you, I think that's why you don't like A River... that's why you loathe The River Runs Through It.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't seem like... You can't have that conversation with it.
That's why Gotti, the John Travolta film, is a way better film than River Runs Through It.
Yeah, sure. It probably wouldn't be for me.
Sure. Let's do Letterboxd. What do you give this film? Speaking of being forced to...
Man.
I gave it 4 stars. Do you give it...
I give it 3.5.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, I give it 3.5 because... Sure. Of Bronson Pinchot, because of Brad Pitt, because of James Gandolfini, because it makes a bunch of interesting decisions, because it's quite funny in parts. Maybe 3. I give it somewhere between 3 and 3.5.
Sure, that's fair enough.
Yeah.
That's good. Let's talk about what these people gave it. My friend...
Imagine if they were just all, like, creepy, ambiguous messages.
Yeah.
So all we can find the letterbox
we're
now.
Broken from the world. What do you think the average spread on this film is? For reference, California was 3.1.
And I was off by 1. I'm going to say 3.6.
Sorry, Dan. 3.9.
Pretty close.
It's a well-liked film.
Sure. That's interesting.
Empire Magazine called it one of the films of the year.
Okay.
Of all time.
Of all time.
Not that year. Let's do a couple of people. Let's do 2. No, I'm not even going to... That's a bit. I can't keep doing that.
As long as it takes.
I want to do 2 of my friends, and then I'll do some carefully curated insane people.
Carefully?
Carefully curated. I don't want to call them insane.
No, they're just the folks of the world going about their business.
2 of my friends. First, Lauren Wilford. Lauren Wilford is the editor of a publication called Brightwall Darkroom. Or she was. It's possible that she isn't anymore.
Okay.
But she was, and I love that publication. They published my profile on Chantal Ackerman, the French filmmaker that I couldn't find published anywhere else. Hmm. They're really great, and Lauren is a fantastic editor. Lauren's 4 favorite films. I'll do them in the order that you've seen them. You definitely haven't seen them. Fanny and Alexander, the Ingmar Bergman film.
I haven't seen that.
It's good.
I really want to see more Bergman.
I mean, I got the whole fucking Criterion box set that you could, like, beat someone to death with. So you're welcome to go on that journey with me. Yes, it is. You beat yourself to death when you realize there's no joy in the world. Kill Bill Volume 2, I know you haven't seen that.
I haven't seen that.
Fantastic film. One of Tarantino's best. Apocalypse Now.
I've seen that.
Good film.
Yeah.
I really need to rewatch that
film.
Yeah,
I probably should too. I haven't seen it in years.
Yeah, I haven't seen it in years either. I'm just trying to think. I think I like that film. I think I like it.
I think it's got good performances.
I think it's got good performances.
And it's so...
Dennis Hopper is
It's so loud.
Yeah, must be good.
Yeah.
And Phantom Thread.
Sure, I like that.
You're a detractor.
Didn't you say I wouldn't have seen any of those films?
No, I said I'll start with the ones
I'm sorry, I understand. Yeah, I've seen Phantom Thread once, and I felt... I prefer The Master...
You prefer Call Me By Your Name. You're
that year, I preferred Call Me By Your Name.
That's a problem, Dan. I
could watch both again and flip.
Phantom Thread could give you whatever you... Mark Kermode once said about The Exorcist, it gives out whatever you bring to it. That's true of Phantom Thread, it's not true of Call Me By Your Name. For better or for worse.
Sure. I would say normally you want that from a film. I'd say that's what art is.
You want it to cash out any number of ways.
Yeah.
Call Me By Your Name does not cash out any number of ways.
It's
very good at what it does.
Maybe, yeah.
How does that cash out any other way than, like, the tragedy of first love, mortality, time passing, nostalgia?
Because all those things speak to each of us distinctly, right? Like, we all experience those things in different ways.
But you could see Phantom Thread and you could see it as a portrait of how relationships have to survive. You could see it as capitalism. You could see it as what you have to do for your art. You can see it as war. You can see it as taste. You can see it as, like, all of these things.
Yeah, but those are just bigger words. That doesn't matter.
That's my favourite kind of words. Lauren says, my life will never be quite the same after seeing Gary Oldman in Grills and Dreads.
Yeah.
It's worth pointing out he's in the film for, like, 10 minutes.
Maybe not even that.
Yeah.
I would say, like, 7.
Yeah.
It's a... it imprints on you, that performance.
He's a very, very, very good actor. He's extraordinary in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Yeah, that film is perfect. It really is. That's a masterpiece. And everyone, so why do I know that's a masterpiece?
Because that's such a polite film, Dan. Yeah. I got your fucking number.
Mm.
Mallory Andrews also writes for a publication, is the editor of Clio, a real good journal. Top four films that I know you've seen a couple of. The Apartment.
Love it.
Good film.
Yeah.
Shirley MacLaine is that's a,
yeah, that's a masterful
unbelievable performance. Just like
her sadness.
Yeah. Well, you talk about histories. Just the minute Shirley MacLaine is on screen, you're like, I know that. Everything about that person.
She brings so much.
Broadcast News. Have you seen that film?
No, I really want to. I think I would really like it. Yeah.
I'm a little bit iffy on Broadcast News.
I think it's my kind of film based on what I understand of it. I think it's
extremely your kind of film. I don't even know. Designed for Living. Ernst Lubitsch. Came out in 1933. I've heard of that. People love Lubitsch. I haven't seen a single Lubitsch.
Okay.
I'm an uncultured swine. Yeah, because I spend my life watching fucking Tony Scott for the 12th time. Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me. David Lynch's best film.
Okay. I don't think it's his best film.
I knew that would poke out. Oh, well, I know that you think it's his worst, don't you?
I actually haven't seen the tractor one.
The Straight Story?
Straight Story.
Straight
yeah.
Story's pretty
I'm
good.
I'm sure I'd like it. I don't know why I haven't seen that.
Yeah.
I mean, I just... Blue Velvet. Or even Lost Highway. Lost Highway does similar things to Fire Walk With Me.
Fire Walk With Me just jumbles me in a way that I'm like... You know, Quentin Tarantino was extremely rude about Fire Walk With Me.
I don't like that. I think it's a good film, I should say. I think Fire Walk With Me is a great journey. I don't really like to think this way, but it would be fascinating to, like, what do you think of that film if you've never seen any Twin Peaks? Maybe it doesn't matter. Especially the David Bowie scene.
Oh, the Bowie scene or the party scene that just goes on and on.
Oh, that's so... I forgot about that. It's so upsetting. And the subtitles. Which the actress who'd been in Twin Peaks refused to be in the film because of that scene. Yeah. Right?
I think that scene is unbelievable. I'm trying to find Tarantino being a dickhead. It's pretty easy to find. Whoa! Appearing on the podcast The Cinephiliacs, filmmaker James Gray called it an incredible film, a masterpiece, and a classic example of how the critics get it wrong. He's right.
He is right.
But he's wrong about everything else. Because he made Ad Astra.
Astra's fine.
Here we go. Here's Quentin Tarantino. You know all those horrible things you said about Quentin Tarantino? You want to get him out again.
Yeah.
After I saw Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me at Cannes, David Lynch had disappeared so far up his own ass that I have no desire to see another David Lynch movie until I hear something different. And you know, I loved him. I loved him.
It's bullshit.
Yeah, whatever.
Total bullshit. It's just a, like, misunderstanding of where Lynch is coming from.
Yeah, absolutely.
But everyone and it was also Bandwagon, right? Like, they got booed at Bloody Cannes.
Yes, yes. Critics are bad. I've said it before, I say it again. I am a critic, I should say. Mallory Andrews, I've been thinking about it. But I do think it's a cop-out that Clarence survives. Isn't what separates romance from true romance a little touch of tragedy? I guess it prevents the film from becoming maudlin, but I'm still curious about what an alternative version might look like.
I'm interested in one of them dying.
No, I'm so not interested in that I feel like we just have a fundamental difference in perception of the world.
Fascinating. Maybe this is where you become inscrutable to me.
Sure, I'm not watching that film. I'm not watching that film. I love them, and I care about them.
But surely there are people you care about and love in films that die that you like.
That I see when they have to die.
Yeah, sure.
Can I briefly sidebar and spoil the plot of Stephen King's Cujo?
If you don't want it, skip forward a minute.
Cujo, do you know the plot of Cujo?
It's a big dog. That's about it.
That's it.
That's all I have.
There's a rabid dog, and a woman and her son are trapped in a car. And basically, the first half of that plot is setting up Rube Goldberg machines to set up the situation where a mother and a son are trapped in a car, and the husband is not expecting to hear from them because there's been a revelation of an affair. He's on a trip. They're talking about breaking up their entire marriage. It's all extremely, because it's King. Very masterfully putting in pieces in place where you understand the emotions that drive them.
And he's out of his mind when he's writing this book.
Doesn't remember it. Insane. That is, yeah. I know, Dan's gesturing to that. I don't have a drinking problem. I'm just really thirsty. Hip flask, which is staring at me. At the end of the book, the so the son has been dying of dehydration because they're trapped in this car and it's
hot. That's the whole book, is there in the car?
The second half, Dan, you should read that book. It's extraordinary. It's one of the top 10 books of all time. I genuinely believe that. Do you know who else believed that? I can get you to agree with me by invoking.
I'm sure it's...
David Foster, Wallace.
Yeah, I think I knew that. He loves King.
He loves King. He thinks that book is a masterpiece.
Okay.
The son is dying of dehydration. The dad finally finds them. They put Cujo, the dog, down. They have to kill it. It's this rabid dog. This is why I love this book, right? Parts of it are narrated from the point of Cujo, and there's a really heartbreaking thing when they're shooting Cujo. He's like, I just wanted to be a good boy. Awful, terrible, break my heart. Saying it aloud. And in the book, the kid dies.
Huh.
And there's this... The kid's just dead. And it cuts forward, and it's like the mother and the father are trying to make it work, but it's like...
I just had the thought that if you probably skip forward a minute, you probably landed on that. Keep skipping forward.
Keep quickly. And in the film, there's a really good film directed by Lewis Teague, and the kid doesn't die. And usually I'm someone who, I think, I prefer dark stuff. We know this about me. I want it to be dark. But I understand why he made the choice for the kid not to die. It ends with the three of them hugging each other, and it goes into freeze frame.
Wonderful.
That makes more... The kid doesn't have to die. Yeah. And Christian Slater doesn't have to die.
He doesn't have to.
Why?
They have a kid at the end called Elvis.
Yeah.
That's how it ends on the beach.
Christian Slater has a badass fucking eye patch.
There's got to be a... You know how Christian Marclay made the clock with moments from films at every time, etc. So many films end on beaches.
Yeah.
Does Manhunter end on a beach?
Starts on a beach and ends on a beach.
Yeah. California ends on a beach.
That ending of Manhunter is extraordinary. It's a great ending. They save the turtle eggs.
I saw a film... Oh, what film is that? There's a bride who runs onto a beach.
Birth.
I saw it... Birth. Birth ends on a beach. Sure Thank does. You, Joseph.
Sure does. This is the best film ever made.
And True Romance ends on a beach.
Yeah. More beaches. Beaches are cool. Right.
Just Christian McClay's The Clock. Just put all the beach endings together.
Yeah, just string it together.
Free art idea. Yeah. Ask for some funding. Submit a grant.
It's Ida.
Oh, yeah, Ida. Our art collective. It's just us and Ida at the talk.
Kayla. Here we go. These are people that I don't know. So Kayla, the profile picture is from Django Unchained. Top four films. Here we go. Django Unchained.
Bad film.
His worst film. Okay. I find it cloying. I find it so difficult to watch.
I also don't like Leo that much, so it makes it hard.
I love Leo, but it's a bad film. Inglourious Basterds. Real good film.
Okay. This person is...
All in.
Yeah.
Francis Ha.
Oh.
I don't like that film. Sure. I don't like Baumbach.
Okay.
Yeah, for exactly the same reason I don't like Sofia Coppola.
Yeah.
What Baumbach have you seen?
Greenberg, Marriage Story. Greenberg Squid is and the Whale. Awful. I liked Greenberg.
Squid and the Whale is I liked very Squid and the bad. Whale.
I like those films.
Which is the best of those
two? Squid in the Whale.
I hate that film.
I saw it years ago once. So 19-year-old Dan likes it. Who knows what I think? But I'm not backing off. I just don't really remember. I remember thinking it was moving and lovely.
The Royal Tenenbaums.
Great film.
I like that film. I like the film a lot.
Yeah.
Wes Anderson's... Do you know the craziest thing about that film?
I want
to
know.
There's a falcon in that film.
Yeah.
Someone kidnapped the Falcon and tried to blackmail production. And that's why there is a line in the film where the Luke Wilson character is like, he looks different. Truly. You could make a film about the people who try
Well, kidnap the Falcon from the Royal Tenenbaums.
Yeah, that's...
Why hasn't Wes Anderson made that film?
Yeah, he should.
He really should. He really Better than should. The fucking Grand Budapest Hotel.
Kayla, this is a wild ride. At times, you can definitely tell that Quentin Tarantino wrote this. No doubt needs more Brad Pitt and Samuel L. Jackson. I mean, definitely needs more Samuel L. Jackson. Needs more
James Gandolfini and Brad Pitt. If
you squash it too hard.
It's funny because the Sam Jackson cameo is now Marvel movies. Yeah. Sam Jackson turning up for 2 minutes.
Yeah, he does it in Marvel.
I wonder if this is, like, if you were to look at the shortest Sam Jackson performances, it would be like...
Sure.
Well, Spider-Man 2, Iron Man 3, Johnny True Swade. Romance... Is he Johnny Swade?
Yeah, for like 32 seconds. We talked about That's it on the right. episode of this he podcast. Is.
Look, I don't remember this.
Okay, two more. Mr. Dulac. Oh, wow. Great top four films. Yeah. I've forgotten how good they are. Bride of Frankenstein. You seen it?
I don't think so.
Everyone forgets that there are. There's a sidebar of the plot in that movie when people are shrunk down to the size of like...
Okay, like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. Psycho.
Perfect film.
Perfect film. Obviously a perfect film. Evil Dead 2.
Haven't seen that or the first one.
Evil Dead 2 is a remake of Evil Dead. You can either see one or the other.
Okay.
It's both exactly the same plot. Both Raimi.
Insane.
I mean, not exactly the same thing happens, but...
Sure.
The first one, Bruce Campbell goes to a cabin and his friends read from the Book of the Dead and it raises deadites. In the second film, Bruce Campbell goes to a cabin in the wood with his friends and reads the book again. And The Thing.
Okay, yeah, I still gotta watch it.
Still, you... Yes, you do. Listener, tune in next week. Groove Man. Here we go. I didn't even give that person fucking...
No, I'm sorry. What's happening?
Mr. Dulac. The best part about this viewing was the group of women sitting next to us that obviously had the wrong expectations, knowing nothing about the film, only having the fact that it was a 90s movie titled True Romance starring Christian Slater to go by.
Yeah, that's gonna mess you up.
Yeah, that is gonna mess you up. Imagine... Could you sell this film to your mum?
No.
No way?
Absolutely no way. Zero way.
You say it's a romance.
No. Zero. Impossible. Nothing about it.
I could maybe sell it to my mum. She just wouldn't talk to me if you did.
Yeah.
My mum would just kind of... My mum is inscrutable. I mean, that's a question for another time. And your therapy.
Different podcast.
Groove Man. Here we go. Top four films. This is what I like, right? It's films that I like, and the films that I don't necessarily love, I'm like, that's very interesting.
Mm.
Wild at Heart, the Lynch film.
It's a great film.
I don't like Wild at Heart.
Really?
I think it's Lynch's worst film. Done,
Nicolas Cage.
I know. That film is just... I watched it... You know something that I genuinely think? When I first watched it, I watched it on VHS tape, and I didn't like it. And I think it's to do... VHS tapes are... scary.
Yeah, they are.
That's why they're haunted in movies.
Definitely. No, it's perfect.
And that's why...
Literal tape, right?
Yeah. Some films are enhanced by watching on tape, and some films are really hurt. I saw Titanic on tape for the first time, and I think it hurt my feelings about Titanic. Sure. Makes it feel glib and weird and...
thin, right?
Yeah, thin. Halloween 2, the Rob Zombie one.
Interesting.
Have you seen any of the zombie Halloweens?
No.
Good.
Or any of the Halloweens.
Really not?
No, of course not.
How are we still friends, Dan?
Well, you haven't made me watch Halloween yet.
Fucking hell. There's not enough hours in the day. Burning.
Oh, the Murakami. Yeah, that's a great film.
It is a great film.
I don't know if it's a masterpiece, but it's a great film.
I don't think it's a masterpiece.
Yeah.
Spoilers, skip forward a minute.
Maybe two.
Yeah, to be safe.
Yeah, especially with something like Burning.
The death at the end is extraordinary.
Yeah.
Extraordinary when the look on Yoon's face when he's been stabbed and the way that
Stephen Yoon's performance
fades down,
so good.
I've returned to Burning a couple of times.
I would like to watch it again.
I think Yoon, I could make the case for it being like one of the all-time great screen performances.
I really am really happy
the
to hear
yawning
you say that.
And the like
and the
side
shifts
eye.
In he's like three different people in that film, but they're all coherent within the one character
and specific.
Yeah.
His character fulfills a vague role, but he's never vague.
Yeah, I love that film so much. It's weird, right? Because I definitely feel it has flaws, but it just does a series of things so well.
I think there's a 90-minute cut of that film that's one of the best films of all time. And that sounds, I'm sure, sounds like blasphemy to
but
some
no,
people.
In that specific, for some reason...
It just needs to be a little bit punchy.
And it can still be meditative with the running and the
sure, it can still feel
and,
long.
Yeah.
And Groove Man's fourth favourite film... One of the top five films ever made. Could you guess? I've made you watch it. It's one of the films that... So what are the films that I say are my favourites? The Exorcist, All That Heaven Allows, and the third one is the other one. It's not
Night of the Hunter?
No, but I like this film more. I've made you watch it.
Drag Me to Hell?
No.
That
would be bold, but...
Yeah.
No, a film real important to me.
The Exorcist?
No, I said that already.
Sorry.
This is all wankery, right?
Yeah.
You don't have to take it seriously.
No, I'm interested.
We saw it at the cinema. It didn't come out, but I made you watch it. I made Ned watch it, and a complete stranger who I don't know, who's very polite, I made them watch it too.
When was this?
We went for dinner beforehand, around Sydney Festival time, film festival.
I don't remember.
This is real fun for the listener.
I don't remember. I think I'm panicking because this is on tape.
The poster is a side character from the film, dressed head to toe and obscured, looking, and they're in it for a very brief moment of this film towards the very end.
Oh, safe. Of course. Yes. Sorry. Thank
God
you.
Haynes is
yeah,
safe.
I don't know why that... You know what? For some reason, I don't... That wasn't around Sydney Festival time. It was quite a bit later.
Huh. Do you know the tagline for safe?
I think I do. I have known it. It's really good, right?
In the 21st century, nobody will be Dot, dot, dot.
Yeah.
Safe.
Wonderful.
They won't be. Sure won't be.
Yeah.
It'll get you. Grooveman says, "Don't condescend me, man. I'll fucking kill you."
Yeah,
man.
Definitely.
Incredible perfect line. All right, last one.
Last one.
I got to find a real good one then. Oh, I mean, this is wild.
Top four?
This is wild. Here's the bio. Here we go. This person's called Siegfried Storsand. Sorry if I mispronounced your name, Siegfried. Clerks will always be my favorite movie, but I'll just be showing off the latest four movies that really made an impression on me on the favorite tabs to the left. Four favorites. Here we go. It's crazy that we keep having to talk about this fucking film because we made our views very well known. Parasite. It's okay.
It's fine.
It's all right. Yeah. Thank you.
Some wonderful scenes.
Yes.
Overall, a little much.
Yes. Number two, Enter the Void, directed by Gaspar Noé.
Okay.
You should see it. Yep. Do you know the plot of that film?
No idea.
It's shot in first person. It's about a guy dying and his soul leaving his body and going back through his history.
Okay.
He's shot while he's on mushrooms.
Okay.
Thanks, Gaspar. Did I tell you when I interviewed Gaspar, he was like, to me, "Do you like mushrooms?" I was like,
you know.
He's like, "They take the edge off. You brew them in a tea, I'll do it for you." Thanks, Gaspar. He was what a champ. Hero, the Zhang Yimou film. Do you remember Hero?
Yeah, I think I haven't seen it, but I think I remember it.
You know who is responsible for getting that film shown widely across America?
Scorsese?
Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, interesting.
He loves those films.
Hmm.
Koyaanisqatsi.
Don't know
those films? Okay, so this dude called Godfrey Reggio makes a series of films in the 90s that are extremely popular. They're called Koyaanisqatsi, Poyaanisqatsi, and Nakayaanisqatsi. And what they are is sped up footage of cities and nature.
Oh.
Set to Philip Glass music going like...
Cool. You mean Philip Glass style music? Or
no, literally, wow. Literally Philip Glass himself. These films are insane. You watch them. You watch them when you're stoned and then you don't remember anything about them. Sure. That's the ideal way. They made so much money. The culture has changed so much. Can you imagine? They made enough money that it's like,
when was this?
Families going. Poyaanisqatsi comes out in 1988.
That's crazy. Yeah,
Poyaanisqatsi came out in 1982. Sorry, so 80s. Fucking people just going to see like sped up footage of people walking through cities and walking out and saying to their grandmother like, "Oh yeah, you should go see
Koyaanisqatsi." I feel like as revenge for imagining the end of history, we're just having to experience all of history at once. That feels so long ago.
It just is impossible to imagine anything like that happening in today's culture. What
and
does
it's
that
worse.
Look like?
It's better. It's better.
Can you imagine people on Twitter like trying to meme on
sped
up footage of nature?
Four frames of.
Lot of history. And Reggio is still alive. What the fuck's he doing?
I would love to know.
Yeah, I'd love to know too. Maybe he's listening to the Brad Pittcast. I doubt it.
BradPittcast@gmail.com. TheBradPittcast@gmail.com.
4 stars. This is a very long review. I'm going to give you the condensed version. Out of 1,000 things in this movie that just reek of Tarantino, the fact that Clarence called out Sonny Chiba as the greatest martial artist working in the 90s makes it unmistakable that Clarence is in fact Tarantino's dream depiction of himself.
That's true.
It's definitely true. I'm a huge sucker for ensemble casts, and especially movies that dare use many huge names without being afraid of killing them off.
Absolutely.
Or throwing them to the curb 10 minutes later. Like everything Tarantino writes, this is a mess. You would agree with that. I don't actually think it's that messy.
No, I don't think Tarantino's messy. I don't agree with that.
Oh, Tarantino in the beginning is definitely
messy. But not everything he writes.
Once Upon a Time is incredibly tightly controlled, tight as a drum. A glorious, intense, well-written, controlled mess. So many balls are in the same air at the same time, but by some miracle it works. See, this will be like, this can sum it up for me. And I always worry that when I'm saying that, I'm like, shut the fuck up,
no,
Dan.
No,
I'm not
please.
Saying that. The tragedy of Tony Scott, that his best reviewed and best rated film is attributed to Tarantino. True Romance is not Tarantino.
No, it's a
film.
Scott film.
You feel that person.
Yeah, and we only recognize the Tarantino moments because we're so familiar with Tarantino.
Sure.
Otherwise, we understand this is a Scott film.
But they're not shot like Tarantino.
No, not at all. And they don't need to be.
No.
And they're better for not having.
Absolutely.
Had that. Yeah.
Absolutely. Do you know what we're going to do next week?
Tell me.
Christmas episode.
Merry Christmas, everyone, or happy holidays.
Happy holidays. We'll be recording it in like 30 minutes from
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah. We gotta churn through them. We got other things to do over the next few weeks.
So you'll hear us in a week. We'll hear ourselves in like 25 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Can't wait.
Love you. See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.